Welcome to Opening Dharma Access, a podcast where we hear stories from BIPOC teachers about their Dharma experiences and practice and how these inform the ways they are sharing the Dharma today. Welcome to Season 3. As indicated in our last episode, Opening Dharma Access, or ODA, is forwarding Asian diaspora Buddhist practitioners this season. I'm Reverend Lian, your host for this episode. Joining me today is the new co-host of Season 3. As listeners may remember from her visit with us in Season 1, Reverend Dana Takagi is a retired professor of sociology and also a Soto Zen priest. He spent 33 years teaching sociology and Asian American history at UC Santa Cruz. He is a past president of the Association for Asian American Studies and has practiced Zen since 1998. Welcome back, Reverend Dana. Hey. Good to see you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for agreeing to be co-hosts for Season 3. I'm so excited to be working with you again.
We're really, we've known each other a long time, so I'm really looking forward to showing other people the depth and range of our friendship and togetherness in Buddhist practice. And so, yeah, let's get it.
Yeah. Let's share with listeners briefly what we're doing this season to really forward Asian in diaspora Buddhist voices, because they're not discussed much in a lot of North American Buddhist settings.
So in our conversations, Reverend Lian and I have had a lot of private conversations about the state of Dharma teaching and the role of Asian Americans. And we started to talk about the ways in which the Asian American experience is very distinctive, in particularly in convert Buddhist sanghas, but also trying to kind of lift up what the nature of that experience is, because I think, you know, a lot of times people like to think about Asians as like or not like an African American experience or a Native experience or Latinx experience. So we've been talking about this idea of the disquiet. Mm-hmm. And the disquiet is a term that comes from the national poet of Portugal, Fernando Pessoa. And I know of it because I know a Japanese historian who used it to talk about why the history of Japan is so different than the history of European development and modernization. So the notion of disquiet sort of appealed, I think, to both of us as a way to start to hone in on what we feel or what Reverend Lian and I have felt. And we think it might be a very specific way to get into the Asian American experience in mainly convert sanghas, but we'll see. That's what the podcast is going to do, is to try to go beyond just, are we like African Americans? Are we like Native Americans? Are we like white sangha members? And the answer to all of that is no. There's a very distinctive relationship for Asians or people of Asian descent in relation to Buddhist practice in particular, and both in terms of how people see us and how we see ourselves and how we see sanghas that we practice with. All of this is not simple. And the disquiet is a way to kind of get into some of the discomfort and dis-ease that mm-hmm. we feel sometimes in practice communities.
I want to clarify a little bit about this whole disquiet idea, which, correct me if I'm wrong, is very much a sense of the suppression or the stereotyping or the pigeonholing of Asian diaspora or Asian Americans as not to be seen, not to be heard. Would you say that, or how would you add to that?
Yeah, no, definitely there's kind of a double layer of meaning around mm-hmm. this, which is that I know in my own history of mm-hmm. practice that I feel a disquiet personally. Mm-hmm. where like little things come up. I don't know, you can call them microaggressions or misunderstandings. Mm-hmm. But then also kind of this other layer is this sort of abandonment of being seen.
So part of it is centered around Buddhism in North America is that in the dominant projection or the dominant view of Buddhism in North America is that it's mostly white people. And then, in fact, the whole, of course, categorizing of the two Buddhism of, you know, the superstitious ethnic Buddhists of Asian heritage and then the white converts as having the modern Buddhism. And so, and then with all the DEIA stuff that's happening, a lot of it's how to bring in other people of color in. And so there's this kind of, as we talked about in last season, especially in the summary, about how in the dominant representation of Buddhism in North America, and very specifically or more specifically in convert setting, is that it's occupied territory of white dominant culture. And so, again, this sense of why the majority of Buddhists in the world, and I would probably say in North America, are of Asian heritage, again, we are disquiet in this way. And so this season, we're really bringing forward the Asian diaspora Buddhist experience to say for ourselves, to clarify for ourselves what that is. And so it's an open project. I want to be very clear that we're not doing it as a reactive. We're just really saying, here's who we are, and here are some of the nuances and the layers and the complexity that you're talking about.
Nice. Yeah. Nice. Perfect. I like the idea of it being an open project as opposed to something that ideologically or politically or otherwise is already determined.
Yeah.
Exploratory in a way.
Right. In a way we're defining as we bring in our guests, and each of us get to define what that is for ourselves and our experience as practitioners of Buddhism in North America. So having said that, I'm really happy again to bring you on, and especially with your background in teaching Asian American studies and also being a priest. And we've been around for a long time in the San Francisco Bay Area Buddhist scene. I want to really reintroduce listeners to you with this lens of how do we open up and clarify what it is to be Asian American or Asian diaspora practicing in North America.
Sounds good.
All right. Let's go. Here are some questions that we'll just start out with. And of course, it's open to our discussions. So first, how do you currently identify racially, ethnically, culturally within the Asian diaspora label? Can you tell us how your identity has changed over time, if it has?
Sure. That's a good question, and that's kind of a hot question, I guess. I mean, to be honest, most of the time, if people say, what are you? I say, I'm Asian American. And I might also say, I'm Japanese American. And then I'll say, I'm third generation Japanese American, which among people who know Asian American history, being a sansei or third generation, I mean, it's a whole generational experience that we are the sons and daughters, children of our parents who were interned during the Second World War. I know that, you know, terms have changed over time. And, you know, from Asian American to Asian American Pacific Islander to diasporic studies. And I know that these are very significant kinds of debates and discussions. But honestly, if I were to tell someone that I'm Asian diaspora, I mean, some of the people I just, you know, see in grocery stores and stuff, they'd like freak out. So I just say I'm Asian American and sometimes add Japanese American. And I mean, you know, the truth is we don't have a lot of control over how people, when you tell them how you identify, we don't have a lot of control over how people then take that and make mm-hmm. sense of it. Mm-hmm. Although I will say, you know, sometimes in Sangha life, people will say, well, so you're Japanese American, so you already know all this stuff about Buddhism. And, you know, that's a kind of, that's wrong. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's not true mm-hmm. in my case. Or maybe if I do know stuff about Buddhism before I came to Buddhist practice, it was really kind of being culturally part of the Japanese American community. So that's, I'm sorry, that's a long answer. I just went on and on.
No, no. But it brings us to the second, just to, again, bring in the nuances of, again, that the label of Asian American Buddhist, Asian diaspora Buddhism. Were you brought up as a Buddhist? What is your religious tradition? And as you said, was it through community? Did your family attend a church or temple or a specific kind of practice? Tell us a little bit about that.
So I was not brought up religious at all. I mean, both my parents were atheists. And what I understood about Japanese Buddhist temples as a kid was that they would have these fairs mm-hmm. that involved boxed chicken teriyaki and corn on the cob and something else, macaroni salad or something like that. Uh-huh. And I really wanted to go to those. uh-huh. But my parents were not really part of the Japanese American Buddhist temple life at all. And it's kind of a whole long thing about my folks, but my folks were much more political and not religious. And they didn't necessarily connect with the Japanese American community in the Bay Area. Uh-huh. So I was brought up to not believe in God or Buddha or anything and came to practice pretty late in life. I mean, I was, 47 or something when I started practice? Mm-hmm. You know, I think like many people, I mean, I don't know, we'll see what people say in as we do these interviews, but I came to practice late as a result of a bunch of different things that were happening in my life. Like I was seeking something. So, but no, I was not religious. So it was very, you know, and for an academic, say in the 1980s, to start thinking about practice, mm-hmm. that's really like, I mean, these days it's not so anomalous, mm-hmm. but back for me, it would have been like the people I hung out with and academics that I knew. It was weird to do that. I mean, weirder than being gay or queer. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So I didn't really tell people about it. I was closet Buddhist for a while.
It is interesting, you know, I do teach for years now with Asian Americans, and many of them have a Buddhist background, and yet it is kind of like a closeted thing, because it's an odd thing about how we have it as part of our family or our community, like you're talking about going to fairs and stuff, like maybe Obon or something, right?
Right.
Or people go to temple, Lunar uh-huh. New Year in Vietnam, right? Vietnamese culture. A parent, usually a mom, and the people I've worked with, you know, would chant at home. Uh-huh. And yet we don't really know what it is to be Buddhist.
Right.
Maybe in some way parallel to in North America, that we're considered a Christian country and people go to church at Christmas or whatever to sing carols, and yet not much else. And so there isn't a context of Christianity to that per se. That's a story, right?
Right, right.
And so to really be engaged in practice, and I think any religious practice is something that is resonates for us deeply, and it takes time and a willingness to say, this is who I am, I think, because mm-hmm. it does come from a deep thing, especially when it is resonating in a way that's not necessarily intellectual or rational because of that deep family or cultural relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I know a lot of people that grew up with Butsudan, you know, like a family type altar thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they particularly, many of the JAs, the Japanese Americans I knew, didn't relate to that. It was just something that they saw their parents do. Mm-hmm. And a couple of my friends, they still have, you know, their parents' altars. Mm-hmm. And one friend in particular, I went and I go, so do you know what this is? He goes, yeah, no, not really. We just keep it. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of funny because this particular friend, he's got all the stuff from his family, you know, the kimonos, the both the cultural and the Buddhist stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't have anything like that. I have a Buddha that belonged to my grandmother, but she converted to Christianity after she had been here in the U.S. for a while. But I grew up with that Buddha on her coffee table. So now it's like an altar in my bedroom. But so maybe I shouldn't say that, you know, there isn't Buddhism in my family, but just in terms of practice, it was a whole different thing when I started to do meditation.
Yeah.
So.
And I want to get to that. And I want to bring up, and I think, again, just having worked with several students who are JA and have similar background to yourself, of course, because of the internment and concentration of Japanese American during World War II, one, people were forced to leave so much behind, or things were taken from them, one. And then there's the whole Buddhism then was, you know, unquote, oriental superstitious thing. And and so I know that several Buddhist religious organization changed to be like Buddhist Church of America or whatever. And so there's the suppression and the of Buddhism within this history. And so I wonder how much of that carried over into your parents of not talking. Again, people leaving the camps didn't talk a lot about what happened there. And it's part of that, the whole intergenerational trauma of being interned.
Right. Well, you know, as everyone knows, or I think most people know, the Buddhist priests and Japanese language teachers were the first to get picked up in the 24 hours after Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, for many people like my parents, second generation, that, you know, there was this kind of push to not be threatening and to claim American citizenship. So I think there are a lot of pressures on JAs in camp. I mean, you know, if you wanted to insist on Buddhism, and many people did still, you know, they still, the Issei and Nisei still identified as Buddhist. Mm-hmm. But there's a suppression of it that goes on in camps. But, you know, as Duncan Williams shows it, there's still also lively Buddhist classes and teachings that went on in various internment camps. I mean, in my family's case, I didn't really know my father's parents, but I know that my father's father was Christian, carried around a Bible.
Okay.
I guess this, you know, Buddha that I have on upstairs in my bedroom, my grandmother must have taken it to camp. I don't know how she got it, unless she got it on a return trip to Japan after camp. That's possible. But yeah, people, at least in my family, there was no like expressive or extant Buddhist beliefs or practice at all.
Tell us a little bit about your Buddhist practice and your Buddhist history. So you said you came in your 40s to it.
Straight up suffering. I mean, I can laugh about it, but I was in a lot of kind of emotional angst in the late 90s. I can't remember if I said this in season one, but I feel like I have had a very successful and gratifying academic career. I had published a book in 1992 on affirmative action that was a boring book, but, you know, I'm still proud of it because I think I was able to learn things about Asian Americans and racial politics, specifically related to affirmative action, And I was getting invited places to speak, and there was job feelers and all this, all of the things that make you a successful, according to the university anyway, academic. And I was really unhappy about it. So I was probably flying and giving talks every other week and even getting a little bit of money, sometimes a lot of money, to go someplace and give a talk. And I felt like it was performative.
Mm.
And it wasn't that I didn't believe what I was saying. It was just maybe I was never meant to really do that kind of academic stuff. So I didn't really like it. I enjoyed it in the sense that it made me feel important, but the more important I felt I was seen as, the more alienated I became.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally I just, somewhere around 1997 or 98, I just kind of put on my answering machine that I wasn't available to do talks. And around that time I went to Japan. And I was invited to give some lectures and spend a month there. And all I did besides the lectures was I went to Buddhist temples.
Mm.
I don't know, there's something there, you know? And I don't know what that was. Something ephemeral. And back then, there wasn't really a lot about Buddhism that was part of popular culture like there is now. So I don't know, you know, depressed, alienated, successful. A kind of a weird combination of like, okay, I could continue to cultivate myself as an expert, but actually I knew that a lot of people, I felt like I was the product of a lot of other conditions and conversations mm-hmm. with people. And it wasn't just that I was such an expert. So mm-hmm. anyway, I was drawn to like less talk, more silence.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to be a Buddhist, just so you know.
Uh-huh.
No one's more surprised than me uh-huh. about this.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted people to stop talking.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sitting and facing a wall was really great for me because no one was talking to me and asking me my opinion or wanting me to do something or...
I think that... You know, that's the thing recently I've been talking about, thinking about how we talk about emotional intelligence, but we don't talk about spiritual intelligence.
Mm.
And I think there, I know I've seen it in the last, 15 years at least, in the San Francisco Bay Area, where there's a lot of Silicon Valley tech people who have really made it. If not famous, then economically, and then they turn towards practice because it is that with a worldly thing, you accomplish all the things you're taught that you're supposed to accomplish, and you're still like, but what is life? What's the meaning of life? What's the purpose of my life? And so I think people do turn towards practice and religion to say, what is here that we have a resonance to that can't always be put into word.
Like, yeah.
For you, like silence or a way of connecting that isn't material.
For sure. You know, this morning I was reading in the New York Times a little kind of portrait of a Salesforce executive, Asian woman. I think I'm not quite sure if she was born in the U.S. or not, but, you know, this reporter's asking her about her success and blah, blah. And she says, you know, I bring to artificial intelligence a beginner's mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I know where you got that.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
and at this point, it's so widespread, you don't even have to, you know, do any attribution for it. But for those of us who are familiar with Suzuki Roshi, you know, that's such a famous line that now just circulates as if it were spiritual common knowledge. So...
And perhaps some people are not sure that the spiritual significance of it.
Right. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
The mind of not knowing and being right. Curious and open. So talk to me about, okay, let's talk about it. What have you experienced as a disquiet in your practice history? And how have you worked with that?
That's such a deep question for me, because I think for the first maybe 12 or 15 years of my doing meditation and getting lay ordained and then priest ordained, all of the disquiet that I felt was just about me, Dana, and whatever it is that makes me feel a little bit like I don't belong. And I was, 100% in to Soto practice. I mean, because I practiced with you at Tassajara when you were a resident. I came down and did an ongo, and I was just, complete novice and kind of learning forms. And so, like back then, in the early 2000s, I didn't feel that disquiet, except this kind of disconnect from my professional life. But and maybe this is kind of opening up a can of worms, but I feel like as the world changed and Sangha life changed to try to be more responsive to the world, then I felt a kind of disquiet in relation to Buddhist practice, which was a kind of Buddhism doesn't solve everything or doesn't really have great things to say necessarily about the state of the world or the way that we try to address the state of the world inside Sangha practice.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, partly that was, the rise of the right, and which later, we're going to call it Trumpism, but really it was happening before Donald Trump. It had to do with, aggression and resentment toward people of color that was becoming much more widespread. Really an anti-affirmative action type, like you guys didn't get here on your own and you're taking away jobs and college admission slots from people who are more deserving. And you didn't have to be white to be saying this. You heard this among a lot of different quarters of people, that a lot of people were getting ahead unfairly. I mean, I really appreciated that a lot of sanghas tried to deal with this by doing well-being ceremonies or doing statements. But as the world became quite a bit more dysfunctional in terms of race, I felt personally like DEIA was well-intentioned, but wasn't a long-term solution.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes some of us say about race, like the more you talk about it, the more I call it the, like, if you're going to pee in the pool, then the rest of us have to swim in it effect. And one of the things about, I remember specifically after Angel Williams published Being Black in 2004, she came to my sangha in Santa Cruz. She said, the Dharma can't stay the same. And boy, Catherine just really she took some umbrage to that. And she didn't say so during Angel's lecture, but the next week, she kind of singled me out and said, well, do you feel this? She wasn't really expecting me to answer, and I was kind of blit, blit. I was about to say something, but then she kind of cut me off. And that was 2004. And as you know, kind of the concerns about inclusivity and access and all of that have only accelerated since then. I don't know. It's not that I don't agree with DEIA. It's just that I don't think I know very much about what sanghas should be doing. And so now you see a lot of people reading books and doing trainings, and I'm personally mixed about, personally and professionally as an academic, I'm somewhat mixed about it. So the disquiet that you're asking about, at least for me in relation to Sangha, is directly related to some of this stuff. And then I hope I'm not talking out of school, but as you know, just because you're ordained or you're a priest or you're a teacher doesn't mean you don't have a lot of ego about status and power and control in sanghas. And both at my local Sangha as well as, you know, other places, I saw enough of this that I became somewhat alienated. I mean, someone once said to me, Dana, if you're not trying to change it, you know, you're part of it. And I'm kind of like, that's the way it goes. You know, I don't really have the power to change other people's egos and how that goes. But I felt in the same way that I was somewhat alienated from the way that one could cultivate the ego as an academic, I felt mm-hmm. like there was some of that going on in sanghas as well. Mm-hmm. I don't quite know how to talk about this in a really totally generous way. And I probably have not fully expressed some of the nuance of it. Mm-hmm. But because I'm culturally Japanese American, I walk away from that kind of stuff. Mm. And I don't know if that will make sense to you or to other people that listen to the podcast. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's a fault of mine that I'm not in there fighting about stuff or arguing about stuff, but that's just how I manage this for myself. So the disquiet grows and then I step back a little bit more. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I'm not even sure I'm being clear about this, but...
let me see if I can tease out a few things to, I know you well, we know each other very well. So indeed. I have some sense and we, you know, known each other well for many years within the same circles, similar circles. So let's see if I can tease this out a little bit for the listeners. One is I would say that, we're both in the Soto Zen convert Soto Zen settings. That this is our training and our lineages, right?
Yes, correct.
And so one, at least in the times we practice, the founder was Shunri Suzuki Roshi, but in terms of the powers when we were practicing was white and very much to the point of really forwarding that they knew Soto Zen and what was the appropriate or that they had the Soto Zen of the world, so to speak.
Yes.
And in fact, I have heard in my training very much belittling Japanese Soto Zen as not Zen enough, by that meaning not practicing enough, by that meaning not Zazen enough, as opposed to, you know, in defining Soto Zen practice as meditation, which is what we see in popular dominant culture in North America of what Buddhism is, when in fact Buddhism itself is very much about the study of the precepts, the living of the precepts and yes. chanting and service and devotion and community of mm-hmm. interaction community, not just community of sitting quietly in a zendo, right? And so festivals like you're talking about, right? So one, it got redefined. And so in a way, to me, that's a disquiet of mm-hmm. Buddhism as mm-hmm. a practice that is predominantly of Asian heritage and therefore yes. of the cultural aspects of many Asian cultures that Buddhism has gone through. So that's one. And then the other thing is because of that dominance, there was very few people of color in these communities practicing. Yeah. And in particular, people of color of North who live in North America and identify as North Americans.
Yes.
And then those who are, because of our background, tended to be Asian for the most part. And mm-hmm. so one, then to fit into that, we were disquieted, like your story about how Catherine basically asked you a question, but then didn't wait for an answer is a yeah. perfect example of this disquiet where when that topic comes up, you know, we get identified, but they're not looking for us for answers, nor are they looking to give us any power to make the shifts and change. And so part of it is that internalizing of the disquiet and some of it's cultural base, right? mm-hmm. Because in a lot of Asian culture, you know, keeping it close and not making waves or conflict, especially again, I know I can speak for myself and that we were raised as females, and so therefore there's also that layer of patriarchy and conditioning. And so that disquiet gets internalized. And then with this riot or the addressing of DIA, and again in North America, very much as a Black issue, which has its ability without a doubt, and within the Buddhist, American Buddhist community, that really actually disquiet Asian diaspora, Asian Americans that much more, because it is about how do we bring in more Black people? And so it's not even seeing us, even though we've been here for a long time.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the disquiet any of us feel in relation to Sangha is also a disquiet of kind of racial politics broadly in society. And, you know, there's a lot of times I feel fairly generous now that I'm somewhat stepped back from a very specific Sangha. Because when you, when we know that it's not because this individual can't see you, but really it's the history and kind of, I mean, hundreds of years of not being able to see Asians or not being able to understand the Asian diasporic experience versus the Black experience. I mean, you know, often we have these top level, superficial, like inch deep understandings of, you know, oh, Japanese American internment. Oh, Black people, slavery. Oh, Native Americans, conquest, domination, taking of occupied land, you know. That's not really inside the cultural nuances and histories that we have over generations been brought up in. And it's a misunderstanding, I think, that many of our sanghas and convert Buddhists have, because, you know, people think, oh, like I remember it was kind of news to me that Soto Zen is only one of dozens of lineages of Zen practice. And I mean, I, for at least 10, 15 years, thought it was like the major one. Like I just didn't read the history of it because I took it as a kind of a truth that was hard and fixed. And now I think, you know, there's a history to Buddhism, including convert Buddhism, that we haven't fully explored in Sangha communities. So I actually do remember in the like late 90s, early 2000s, people would say, oh, San Francisco Zen Center is the first Soto Zen practice, right? And that's really been corrected in the last 5 or 6 years, maybe 10 years longer. But, you know, the recognition of Zen Shuji or other, you know, Soto missions wasn't really, and it's because we were not knowledgeable about the context of Buddhist practice. So,
well, and it's also the, like all oppressive forces, who has the mic, so to speak, or who has, you know, who gets to forward the story, right? And for many years, San Francisco Zen Center had the mic on, or better way to put it actually is within the convert Buddhist powers in North America, they always gave the mic to San Francisco Zen Center to represent Soto Zen.
And I should say that for our listeners, whatever indictments you might hear about San Francisco Zen Center, this training that I undertook and the teachers that I met, not all of them, but many of them, you know, this is the most significant thing in my life. And so I want to separate some of the organizational histories and truths about a big leading the mothership, as we call San Francisco Zen Center. Yeah, of course, you know, some individuals maybe are more responsible than others, but I think this is a culture and cultural politics of an organization that should be placed in some kind of historical context. So it's easier to say that since I am not a full-time resident, I think things would be different if I were in full-time residential practice or if I was dependent on an organization for my future care and livelihood and that kind of thing.
Sure, because that disquiet would then actually...
A roar.
Would actually contribute towards you not being taken care of if you were more fully part of the organization.
I wanted to say that, I don't know if this is true, but I suspect that for many of us who are of Asian descent of some kind, because we come from cultures in which the familial line is so important, I think a lot of us reserve and preserve a line between my given family and the so-called family of Sangha. I know I did. Like, I'm always kind of like, yeah, I'm going to say that you're my family, but you're not really. To my Sangha. Like, yeah, you're going to bring me soup when I'm sick, but, you know, when push comes to shove, I'm not sure that you'll be there, is how I have always felt. Maybe that's just me being uptight and paranoid about who will take care of me or who will help me when I really need. But I think I have always maintained that line, for better or worse.
Wait, so let's just clarify what you just said. You're saying that as a person of Asian heritage, is that the word you use?
As a Japanese-American.
As a Japanese-American, the sense of family is very much embedded with duty and responsibility, and you take that very strongly.
I do.
And so... Sure. In these sanghas, in these Buddhist sanghas, which have an Asian base but is dominated by white supremacy culture, we'll just say it, or white dominant culture, they may take that on as a learned thing because it's embedded in Buddhism. Yeah. And yet when in the action, they don't do it. That's what you're saying.
Well, I don't know if they don't do it, but I don't.
They rarely do it.
I don't trust that they would do it.
Yeah.
So, because I feel like, I mean, you know, as queer people, we might say our kind of birth families and our chosen families. And really part of the heart of that is the recognition that one feels and the security of being seen and cared for. And I think that the language in many sanghas is we will take care of you. We will take care of one another. And for some reason, I never felt like that would happen with me. So, I mean, yeah, I have bronchitis. Someone's going to bring me soup. But it's really the close friends and compatriots that you make along the way who I would, in fact, very much rely on. But just organizationally, I feel like that was one of the ruptures for me. What we're saying about disquiet, this is kind of a work in progress. Or that's how I think of it. I will say that as I've aged, I feel like I know a lot less than I pretend to know.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I think it'll be really interesting, this series of conversations that we're having with our guests to try to lift up some of what we think is a nuance or way to get into the Asian American, Asian diasporic experience in practice communities. I had a colleague once who said to me, I get it. You and she named a colleague of mine who's Japanese American. She goes, I get it. You guys won't aggressively talk, but if I shut up for a while, maybe you'll say something. And I thought, I mean, that person said this to me maybe 30 years ago. And I think generally that's accurate, you know, for me. Maybe that's not necessarily true of all Asian Americans. But I thought that was appropriate. So.
Yeah, and I really appreciate that because more and more I think this whole inclusivity thing doesn't quite touch it because it implies a group that brings something in when really it's about moving aside and making room for others. Mm-hmm. And so again, I think this really echoes what our intention is with this season of opening Dharma Access, which is we're going to make space for other Asian diasporic Buddhists, and not just teachers, because that's another issue that's all not necessarily easy to find us as teachers in the dominant or in the very established lineages, because again, of that whole disquiet issue and oppression, of course. So we're going to make space for us to define ourselves or share ourselves, not even define, for ourselves and with ourselves. And we invite anyone who wants to be part of it and to hear us to join us.
Indeed. May it be of service.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This has been Reverend Lian, your host for this episode of Opening Dharma Access with Reverend Dana Takagi, the new co-host for this season. Reverend Dana has been sharing their Dharma experience as an Asian diasporic teacher. Look for them as they share their discussions with more teachers and practitioners in the coming months. Look for new episodes on the first Tuesday of every month. In between episodes, we'll also share meditation, mindfulness practice, chant, or another form of practice or sharing of the Dharma from our guests with you. Come back to check that out and keep on listening to our Asian diasporic practitioners. Be sure to subscribe for notifications and rate and review the podcast to help us spread the word. Check the episode notes for resources and email us at suddenleap.2z@gmail.com with any questions. Let's open Dharma Access to all beings.